Thank you very much. I'll bet Mitt Romney or Sarah Palin didn't get this kind of reception last week. I'm here and, I saw them on TV last week. I said, I think I can do better than that. So here I am. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight and in your support of New Hampshire Public Radio. People like you keep us going and just keep doing what you're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing. Well, about a year and a half ago, I had a chance to drop the newscast part of my work and become NPR's roving ambassador. I would keep my job as judge and scorekeeper on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but, well, here are things I'm not... Here are things I'm not doing anymore. I'm not getting up at 1 o'clock Monday through Wednesday mornings, a.m., to go to do newscasts. Breezing into work down Connecticut Avenue to DuPont Circle, left on Mass Avenue to work. That took about 20 minutes. I used to park anywhere I want to in the parking garage. I'm not doing that anymore. And I'm entering a nearly empty building. I'm not doing that anymore either. And being able to work in the read-in area in near silence. And I'm not leaving at midday with the rest of the day and lots of sunshine left. Here's what I am doing. Sleeping until 6 o'clock in the morning. Putting the dog out after I shower and shave. Having breakfast with my wife. Dealing with rush hour traffic. It now takes about 45 minutes. I have to look for a parking space in the parking garage. I walk into a building where there are many, many people already up and about. I have my own office where I've been piling up junk now for a year and a half. And I'm working with and coming in contact with a lot of new people. There was a time that I could walk up and down the halls of NPR and say hello to everybody I met and call their name. Today I can't do that. We have so many new people into what we do, and with the internet part of what NPR does, online work. We have a lot going for us at the moment. I want to talk about two of my favorite programs and then move on to something else. Morning Edition. Okay? When I joined NPR back in 1977, we were doing just three newscasts in the morning, and that's what I did. Almost like a part-time job. And I helped to prepare for the afternoon newscast, too, on All Things Considered. The stations wanted a program in the morning to balance what ATC was doing. All right, we'll do that. So we brought in some people from the commercial world to fashion a morning news program, like All Things Considered. They were very successful in the commercial world. A lot of them worked at WMAL there in Washington, had a great news department. But they didn't understand public radio and what the public radio people wanted. So we began doing some pilots. I was, of course, there in place to begin with. I did the bottom of the hour newscast. Jackie Judd, who was a reporter, did the top of the hour newscast. We sent pilot programs out to the stations. They didn't like what they heard. This went on for a month, 6 weeks, sending out new programs, and they thought the programs were getting worse and worse. So I went home one Friday afternoon thinking, what in the world are we gonna do now? And Saturday morning in the Washington Post, the story read that NPR had fired the whole staff and had hired people inside the company to develop another program that the station would like. So we brought in Frank Fitzmaurice as executive producer, Jay Kernis as producer. We borrowed Bob Edwards from All Things Considered to be a host, and Barbara Hochter, who did Weekend All Things Considered, to be a co-host. And we did go on the air on time on November 6th of 1979. Now, what about those people who were fired? Well, there was a host that they had brought in, and two hosts, actually, Pete Williams and Mary Tillotson. Pete Williams left us and went on to NBC, where today he covers the Supreme Court. You've seen him many times, I'm sure. And Mary Tillotson, who did some work with public broadcasting for a while, and she kind of faded from view. I'm sure she's out there doing a tremendous job, as she always did. But that's how it began for Morning Edition. Now, first day on the air, big story broke. Big story. That was the weekend that these people took over control of the American embassy in Iran, in Tehran. And the story lasted for 444 days before Iran released their hostages. Interestingly enough, some of those hostages came to NPR to visit our tape library and listen to our coverage of the story. They thought our coverage was better than what anybody else was doing. And you know, it seems like a number of large stories began on our watch in the morning as opposed to the afternoon or the evening. And remember this, early on, we did not do newscasts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We would only fill the gap between the programs, all things considered in Morning Edition, if there was a real big story breaking. We didn't have the staff to do it 24/7. And looking at a few of those breaking stories, there was the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul II on May 13, 1981. And we had the Oklahoma City bombing. And of course, we had 9/11. But during this early period, our resources were not as extensive as they are today. Now, one thing also happened, the shuttle Challenger, when it went up. I had just finished my 11 o'clock newscast and was doing some paperwork, and I reached for my coat, it was in January, ready to go home. But I'm gonna hang around and watch the liftoff of the shuttle. And when I saw what happened, it looked like there had been an explosion, trails of smoke going off in different direction. I took my coat off because I knew I'd be on the air at 12 o'clock, a few minutes down the road. And I was, and as I said, we didn't have a lot of resources back then, but with the help from the library, our research library that dug up information on a previous tragedy on a shuttle in which Gus Grissom and some other astronauts were killed, I had that to go on, and the folks in the booth were telling me on my headset that the White House had a statement, we'll have it ready in just a few seconds, hang on. So I did that. Well, we had 9/11, of course, and that was quite a morning. I remember going out for some coffee, coming back and seeing on the screen smoke coming out of one of the Twin Towers. And my question was, what happened? And somebody said, oh, a plane flew into it. I remembered back in the mid-1940s when I was just not so big, Air Force bomber crashed into the Empire State Building. But that was a foggy day, and this was a clear day in New York. Then, of course, the other tower was hit, and things began happening at NPR. We had the plane that crashed into the Pentagon, and then we had word that the State Department had been bombed. Story we didn't go on. We like to have two sources to tell us something like that. And of course, it didn't happen. Glad we didn't go with it. By the time the morning was over, I remember looking out the window at planes flying over, if there were any, because you don't know what's happening or what somebody may be doing. And looking out on the street when the government workers were let off work, people just running down the middle of the street, getting to their cars to go home. It looked like a 1950s science fiction movie where Godzilla was attacking a town and people were trying to get out. It looked that weird. I finally was able to get to my car when my shift was over and go home. And by golly, I had almost no gas at all. But I did make it home. And it's a day that I'll remember, and the folks who worked with me that morning will remember too. You know, in a situation like that, how do you put together a newscast when things are breaking so fast? If you write something, it's going to be outdated by the time you get to the studio. So you're more or less looking at what the wire services have. You print some of that copy that you're going to use some information from, and you underline what you want to put on the air. And then you have your own reporters, you have your own sources which are digging up information for you. So you're going into the studio not with a well-written script, but with segments here, there, and everywhere. And you know about what order you want to put them in, and you kind of put it together as you go along. I guess that's what they call you. They say you're calling upon previous experience to do this sort of thing. I guess so, but boy, that is where you... I hope I get it right. You can always, at the end, if you run out of stuff, you can go back and recap. and at the same time, people are talking to you on your headphones, telling you what is new. And of course, by that time, not all things considered, but Morning Edition has thrown its roadmap out the window, and they're putting together a new one and putting it together as they go along, too. Quite an experience, but as I look back over my career in broadcasting, I can say that it's been a real, real great trip. Well, to begin with, when I was young, even before I started at school, I wanted to be in broadcasting, and as time went along, I thought, you know, broadcasting looks like it might not be any work at all. And that would be the kind of job I wanted, one where you could have fun. And I have been in the business now, get this, 61 years. Began back in 1950 when I was in high school, and I haven't worked a day in my life. It's been a joy. Even on the rough days, you walk home and you go home and you feel like you've done a good day's work. And I have really enjoyed it. I also got involved with another program later on in life, and people ask me about that program more than anything else. But generally, what they say is, "Will you do the voice on my home answering machine?" And I say, sure, glad to do it, and just call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. They'll tell you what to do. And what they will say is, leave your name and your telephone number and tell us something about yourself and tell us where you're from and what you do. And I don't do the work. Emily Ecton, one of our producers in Chicago, does it. And she gets the stuff on the internet and also from phone calls like that one and also by regular mail. So they're looking for real interesting people. So if you've tried it, try it again and make yourself sound real interesting. You might make it. And another question I get is, who does the voice on your home answering machine? Well, it's not me. My wife, and she's not giving it up. No way. And whenever I call my son, who lives in Ashburn, Virginia, with my two lovely granddaughters out there, and they're not home, the voice I hear is my oldest granddaughter, 10 years old, Kathleen, saying, please leave a message for the Castle residents. So, and I have a brother and two sisters. They said, don't even bring the subject up. So don't do that. Anyhow, a couple of years before Wait, Wait went on the air, back in 1997, I suppose, I was in Boston at a public radio program directors conference, and a number of NPR personalities were sent to kind of schmooze around, you know. And one evening, I was asked to preside at a meeting and introduce these NPR glitterati. I did, and I cracked a few jokes. And when I finished, I said, that's it. And somebody in the back yelled out, but you haven't told us anything about yourself. You've talked about them. You haven't talked about yourself. What do you want to know? Well, you do newscasts on Morning Edition, right? I said, yep. And you have to get up in the morning, early in the morning, don't you? I said, yep, I do. What time do you get up? I said, 5 minutes after 1 o'clock. Why don't you get up at 1? Because I like to sleep in. That joke led to my being offered a chance of being on this new quiz program. Doug Berman, the executive producer, the guy who also is the executive producer for Car Talk, he thought it was the funniest joke he'd heard in a long time. So I was asked if I wanted to be that, be on that program, and I took it because early on in my career, I was a DJ up until I discovered news after we moved to Washington. I lived in North Carolina. I'm a Tar Heel, grew up there, and at the local radio station, and also when I went to the University of North Carolina, and after 2 years of the Army, came back to my hometown. I was a morning DJ, having fun, entertaining people. That's what I wanted to do. I'd done theater work in my hometown and also at college and elsewhere, and I love to entertain. News, boring, you know? So I did that, Then we moved to the Washington, D.C. area in 1965, worked at a station in Alexandria, Virginia, and finally got a chance to go to an all-news station where I could make some more money. That was the big attraction at that time, had a family. So I took that job and I left the records behind. But I want to do some name dropping tonight too, because there are three people that I have been associated with that I've enjoyed them and still do to some degree all along. When I was in high school, one of my teachers told me that I should go into the theater, into acting. I was a senior, and by that time I had done 2 years working at the local radio station. I worked in the morning, played records and so forth. And I told Andy Griffith, who was a teacher, yes, the Andy Griffith, no, I think I'll stay in radio. He taught school for 3 years in my hometown and gave it up because he didn't like it. He wanted more excitement. He wanted to be a performer himself, an actor. And of course, you know about his career. He did do, during the summer, I remember this because I was in the show myself, out on the Outer Banks of North Carolina on Roanoke Island. Each year, they do the outdoor drama called The Lost Colony. It's about the first British colony in the New World. And in that play, for several years, Andy Griffith played Sir Walter Raleigh, very dashing Sir Walter Raleigh. Okie dokie, we go to the University of North Carolina, and one of my college mates was a guy named Charles Kuralt. And we did a lot of work with the radio TV department, and I miss Charlie today. To me, he's probably one of the best writers that the medium has ever had. All right, now to back to Washington. We moved there back in 1965, and I went to doing all news. Well, I became news director, believe it or not. And one day, one summer, 1982, I think, somewhere by 76 maybe, it was an election year, my boss left me a note one day and said, there's a friend of the family who has a daughter at the University of Virginia. She's a journalism student, and she's looking for an internship this summer. She might be a good help for you. So he left the number to call and her name, and I called Katie Couric. And Katie came by, and she was delightful that summer. So those are three people I'm very proud of. They really established themselves in broadcasting. All righty, now let's go back to, wait, don't tell me. The program went on the air back in January of 1998. We're in our 14th year now. At the beginning, we were looking for ways to define ourselves. It had to be a program that involved listener participation, and it had to deal with current events in a funny sort of way. Now, when you have listener participation, you want to give them a prize. We didn't have any money to buy any tote bags or coffee mugs. So, Carl, would you do telephone messages for a short time till we get some money? That was about 3,000 messages ago. Well, anyhow, how would we do comedy with current events? Well, trying to find a way to, you know, hang your hat on. How do we do about it? Well, as Peter Sagal said, it was like manna from heaven when the name of Monica Lewinsky came along. It was then that we realized that as long as we have governments, whether federal, state, and local, as well as foreign governments, we would have material. Soon we had added stupid criminals to our list, and the list goes on and on. So let's see, just as we thought our material was drying up, then we always came up with some new material. Now our first celebrity guest, we had trouble getting celebrities at the time, was Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, the former secretary. In a discussion about her routine now that she was out of office, Ms. Albright told us she worked out every morning, could press X amount of pounds with her legs, and Peter wondered if this was of any use in international diplomacy. She said, yes, it was good for kicking ass. Well, that quote made the newspapers that weekend, and soon Madeleine Albright's comedy career was launched. She, She could be seen on all the talk programs. Well, as our audience grew, we found out that we have a lot of well-known people listening. For example, through a mutual friend, we found that Tom Hanks, the actor, is a regular listener. That led to his appearance on our show the next week. And we also found out that he was very competitive. He didn't like to lose anything. When he grew up with his siblings, he had to win all the games and so forth. All righty, so play this one, Tom. And he did, and it had to do with questions about Marlon Brando. And there were interesting questions. He stopped Peter at one point and said, "Peter, can I make a statement to you?" "Yes." "Damn you to hell, Peter Sagal." He didn't like it a bit. He didn't like it a bit. All right, that led to his appearance on the show. When we found out that NBC anchorman Brian Williams played his game with us on the weekend, that led to his first appearance the following weekend on the show. And when we did Carnegie Hall about a year and a half ago, for the first time, by the way, he was our celebrity guest. And we also had, we used to call celebrities and they wouldn't return our calls. This time, once in a while, we have people to call us. And one day, we got word from Dick Van Dyke that he wanted to be on the show. You bet your life you'll be on the show. He was so delightful. The guy is in his 80s, still doing the song and dance performance out in California. And he talked about Mary Poppins, about how they would do a sequel to Mary Poppins, but Walt Disney died before they could get going with it, so it never happened. But at the end, this charming guy said, "Do you know the Dick Van Dyke theme song? Da 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 da." "Yes." "Did you know there are words to it?" "No." "Shall I sing the words?" "Yes." And he sang the words for us. The guy's just delightful. One of our guests was Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Now, when we did the show in California a few years ago, our guest celebrity was Linda Ronstadt. She brought along a friend whose husband was Breyer's brother. And one thing led to another, and presto, Justice Breyer was on our show a few weeks later. And the first question to him was, "Mr. Justice, a distinguished jurist like you, why would he appear on a program like this?" He said, "Well, my sister-in-law wanted me to do it, and I wanted to keep peace in the family." And he became the first Supreme Court justice, by the way, to ever appear on a radio or TV quiz program. Now, let's see. Oh, yeah, one day we got a call from a local fella who heard Peter playing around with his name. He wanted to come on the show and make a statement. So we said, okay. Well, since the local people knew who he was, we didn't let them know that he was going to be there until he arrived. And when he arrived, we introduced to the crowd the junior senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. And Mr. Obama came on. And very charming, very funny. And toward the end, Peter said, "Senator, I got a bone to pick with you." "Yes, Peter." "Senator, you don't agree with children graduating from kindergarten, in the fourth grade and the eighth grade. Why not?" "Well, Peter, I don't agree with that. Because you see, if they have that graduation, kindergarten, fourth grade, and eighth grade, by the time it gets to the big one, the real important graduation, it's been deleted, been diluted. And it doesn't mean as much as it would have if they have just one graduation." "I know, Senator, but graduating from the fourth grade was one of the biggest days of my life." He said, "I understand, Peter, and look what it got you." Okay. All right, one more joke, and I'm going to wrap it up here. Talking about stupid criminals. Well, this guy he was having a problem with someone, wrote a letter to that someone threatening violence and a promise to stalk that person. The young man put the note in an envelope, sealed it, addressed it, put it on the table near the front door, along with the letters his mother was going to mail later. A little later, Mom came by, looked at the envelope, saw that her son forgot to put the return address on it. She did it for him. Her son was arrested a few days later. Anyhow, those are my two favorite programs on NPR.